This week, we're talking about the problems of mass and scale. That means that today, hot on the heels of James Burnham, we are talking about Jacques Ellul and his main ideas. Let's not waste any further time. I will just remind you that I do sell courses here at the academic agency. Trivium is the bestseller. If you want to know more about politics, it's Foundations of Politics. There's Foundations of Economics, Shakespeare, many other great courses, but let's get back to the lecture at hand. Jacques Ellul believed that technique encompasses far more than simply machinery or technology. It is the totality of methods rationally arrived at having absolute efficiency in every field of human activity. Crucially, it has become autonomous, developing according to its own internal logic and largely independent of human intentions, cultural values, or ethical frameworks. So Ellul believed that the striving for efficiency in every field and efficiency becoming the only metric by which to consider anything at all, its use, right, its utility. This had overtaken pretty much every area of life by a certain point in the 20th century, such that society-wide, we almost became hooked on technique itself. The technological society, therefore, is defined by the pervasive dominance of technique. Rationalized, efficient methods have penetrated every domain: medicine, education, governance, art, and interpersonal life. The technological society is not a future condition. For Ellul, it is the present reality of Western modernity. Now, you might be thinking that we have moved on from the technological society, that this no longer governs things, that, you know, such things as the woke and, you know, humanitarianism and compassion for refugees and so on have overtaken, that values have kind of come back in some way. But I would take a look at what is happening across universities in the West, where humanities departments are being absolutely stripped down, decimated, funding being taken away, simply because these departments have no discernible use. You know, when I was working full-time at a university, there was a huge emphasis on demonstrating quote-unquote impact. I remember reading frankly absurd proposals for projects on, let's say, Geoffrey Chaucer. But because of the need for demonstration of technique from the technological society, the demands of whatever project this was, they had to basically demonstrate that there was a use to studying Chaucer. You can't just study Chaucer in and of itself. It has to have a use. And in this one paper, I will never forget, it was a book proposal that I was considering that I had to write a review for. They were arguing that we could go back and read the Canterbury Tales for insight into agricultural techniques, in order to further the overarching goal of sustainability. And I mean, me just being honest, not just refusing to play the game, I just said, this is just nonsense. This is just pants, reject. But anyway, many other people who do play the game wouldn't have rejected it. Oh, this is a fantastic proposal, a brilliant idea. And of course, this will demonstrate quote unquote impact in the real world. Load of guff. So yeah, the point is that because arts subjects and humanities subjects don't sufficiently demonstrate technique, they're under constant threat of being on the chopping block because, you know, while they may generate money by bringing in students, they don't really demonstrate you know, the furtherance of technique. That's why there's such a kind of STEM bias in our society in general, you know, and why there's been drives that get women into STEM, because there's prestige attached to those things, because those things develop technique. There is also efficiency is seen as the supreme criterion by which to judge everything. So if your humanities department is inefficient, it's going to be for the chopping block, but so it is with everything in modern life. Before technique, values such as tradition, morality, beauty, and human scale competed as legitimate standards for social life. What's the point of building that cathedral over there? Well, we want to worship God and it looks nice. Just really kind of awe-inspiring. Yeah, waste of money though. What's the point? What's the point of building that statue there? Oh, well, you know, we're honoring the emperor and it looks pretty cool. Yeah, waste of money. Absolute waste of time and effort. What's the point of all of those nice bits there that the Victorians put on, you know, this bridge or this this monument that they've put here? Oh, well, you know, extravagance, waste of money. This is very, you can see how the sensibility of the age of technique is against any form of ever value creeping in. Under technique, which is what we have all lived under our entire lives, pretty much. And the thing is that people often imagine themselves as not part of this. But I guarantee you that if the government of Britain decided that they were going to start, you know, building monuments or really kind of nice buildings and so on, there'd be a significant portion of people who watch this channel who'd be decrying the quote unquote waste of money. Efficiency becomes the overriding criterion. All other values are subordinated or eliminated if they impede maximum output. Everything boils down to the calculation. How can we maximize per unit output, per unit of input? Alul's point is that efficiency is not bad in itself, but that the elevation of efficiency as being the summum bonum to supremacy, the value above all other things, forecloses moral and cultural reasoning altogether. If you go back in the annals of this channel, I have made many arguments against the elevation of technique in various different... I remember once I made a video arguing against a guy called E.M. Penner, as well as against Richard Hanania, who want to use measurements such as GDP or the price of bananas to structure the whole of society and also to justify things like mass immigration and cheap labor and so on and so forth. My point being, some things are more important than cheap bananas or, you know, the price of your coffee. Unfortunately, many people in our society do not think in that way. Therefore, the reign of technique continues. René Guénon called this the reign of quantity. There is a self-augmentation of technique. You get the technical advance, which generates new problems, which demands new solutions to the new problems generated by the new technique, which therefore requires further technical advance. From a capitalistic point of view, it's almost a perfect circle. Kind of, you know, I can imagine boardroom saying, well, this is a virtuous circle. You know, we bring out this product and there's our next product cycle. Technique grows by its own momentum. Each advance generates fresh complications, environmental, social, psychological, that are then framed as technical defects requiring yet more and more technical intervention, and the cycle is self-sealing. Now, what I find particularly interesting in this is the psychological as a dimension. Maybe down the line, I will tackle Christopher Lash as one of my great thinkers, as well as perhaps Paul Gottfried, who talked about the therapeutic state. One of the things I find interesting, there's this book called the DSM-5. And, you flick through this book and it kind of has all of these pathologies, all these modern, autism and ADHD and, this syndrome and that syndrome and this order or this disorder. And you kind of flick through there and you think, it wasn't that long ago. People would just say, well, this person's just a bit obstinate. This person's just a bit kind of excitable. This person, like, there was a different way of describing these things. And in a strange way, society was more accepting of the people who didn't quite, who weren't quite like everybody else. It was just like, well, this is just your character. So I've often thought, well, this DSM, what is this normal person at the center of the DSM? They talk about neurodiversity and neurodivergent. That's the kind of buzzword of the past 10, 15 years or so. Divergent from what? Divergent, like, from whom? Who are you talking about? And if you really take that book, the DSM, seriously, and I'm kind of freewheeling a little bit here from Alul, but I think these are the sorts of areas that Alul can make you think about. So I think this is a real one for us to consider, is that the only reason that something like the DSM would come about is if the social order demand people to be a certain way. What is wrong with the neurotypical and the neurodivergent? These are the two categories. Well, what is the neurotypical person? The neurotypical person is socially agreeable. The neurotypical person is a conformist. The neurotypical person basically is a good employee. The neurotypical person is swept along by technique, whereas the neurodivergent person is a problem for technique in the age of quantity. So this is a whole area that I truly believe that one day people will look back on the DSM as being a real moment where kind of things went wrong in a way, or people started thinking in a very, very wrong way. Jacques Ellul, in many ways, kind of pointed this out first by kind of showing that it kind of creeps into every area of life in places where you least expect it. There is also in the age of technique or the technological society, the illusion of control. Human beings believe that they wield technique as a tool. In practice, they adapt themselves, their schedules, their values, their cognition, their mental health even, their categories of mental health even, to its requirements. Political and moral decisions increasingly follow technical imperatives rather than the reverse. The controller becomes the controlled. In other words, the machine does not exist for you, you exist for the machine. Or, in Ellul's language, the technique. He talks about how technique captures the state, planning. In governance, everything is reorganized around technical criteria, forecasting, optimization, data-driven administration. All of these things displace deliberative politics. And, here on this channel, I have reviewed all of the films with my buddy Simon and a few other people. We have reviewed all of the documentaries of Adam Curtis. And Adam Curtis is, if you've never seen his films, he is particularly interested in the takeover of technique as a means of management and as a means of governance. And in one of his documentaries, The Trap, he shows how under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, we found the final transformation into the kind of technological age, where government came to be target-driven, data-driven, and these tools of management were brought in. And this is where the James Burnham and the Jacques Ellul crossover, because the managerial class, in Burnham's terms, love technique, or they love the tools of technique. And so wherever they predominate, they'll replace the qualitative with the quantitative. They will replace people doing things by local knowledge or touch and feel, those things that Michael Oakeshott valued, with quantitative measurements, with efficiency drives. And what's one of the great ironies, I think, is that the more and more they speak this sort of language, the less and less efficient they become. I mean, I talked about the Victorians and their beautiful bridges and their monuments and their, you know, extravagant ornamentation. Yet it does not escape my observation that it took them, what, a year or two to knock up a bridge? And I will drove past it many times. Hammersmith Bridge is still there, unfixed after 6-7 years now. Driving here to the lodge, right? Every day. Every day I drive here, M25, down the A3. Okay. The A3 had works, right? They were expanding on junction 10 of the M25. They were expanding the roundabout. How long did this take? It literally took about 3 years of traffic jams every single day, queues all the way up, you know, and obviously that created more problems and created more problems, all done in the name of efficiency. So I just want one of those ironies to me that the more and more they speak this management language and more they become hooked on technique, as Ellul describes it, the less efficient they seem to be. Why were the Victorians so much more efficient, seemingly, than we are now? I mean, it's a genuine question. They certainly achieved stuff in a faster rate than we manage to today. In administration, you get bureaucratic structures that adopt technical rationality as their primary operating logic, rendering human judgment secondary. And again, I've talked about this in previous lectures. You know, it even became a meme. Computer says no. Computer says no. And this can actually be a real problem. You know, you could be in a mortgage meeting. You know, you're sitting there, you've got the money. Our computer says no. Oh, brilliant. Or whatever else it is. Whatever, you don't have the right, you know. And so everybody is kind of used to this at this point, because we've had decades of it. Or our entire lives have been under this sort of administration. And then control. The state becomes an instrument for extending technique's reach, legitimizing its expansion through law, infrastructure, and policing. This is why everybody in the back of their mind wants to resist things like digital ID that Tony Blair and others have been banging on about for years, because they know that that's the next domain of technique. This is the next expansion of the remit of their power. Under these conditions, we see a transformation of the human. Technique does not merely alter the environment, it remakes human beings to fit its requirements. Education trains for function, work disciplines for productivity, leisure is rationalized for recovery. Even psychology is reshaped so that individuals operate efficiently within technical systems. And that was really what my rant about the DSM was about. You know, it's almost like modern psychology sees people, human beings, as a problem to be managed. And, you know, in the years of doing this channel, I've come across many government documents that talk about, quote, behavior modification. Right, this was under the Tories. This document was released when I think when Rishi Sunak was the prime minister. They talked about behavior modification of the public. They talked about, you know, how are we going to get people to behave, to live in the sorts of ways that we want them to. There was a rather large drive to get people to start eating plant-based products rather than meat. Now, it failed dismally. Right? I will say that it failed dismally. But that does not mean that there weren't all sorts of clandestine, semi-transparent nudge unit operations that went on from the top down, from the government on down. And those papers are still there. You can look them up. Which talked about, you know, basically re-engineering all of society to get people used to eating plant-based burgers. Okay, this was in the age of eat the bug. That was the kind of meme version of it, the evil Klaus Schwab. Do you remember? I think basically they botched that, or they're just not going to be able to do it. So I think they gave up on it. But the fact is, they tried, and this very much, you know. Is part of the thinking. People are a problem to be managed. Okay, you don't work with the grain of what people are like already. You diagnose them with problems if they deviate from the requirements of technique. Now, Alul, he didn't just write. He wrote lots of books. One of his books is simply called Propaganda, and really, some of this material is from there. He says, modern propaganda is itself a technical enterprise, not a mere deception. It deploys systematic methods to integrate individuals into the technological society. Its goal is not simply to persuade, but to manufacture consent for technique's continued expansion and to preempt resistance before it forms. Now, on this, I will keep on saying, and I'm going to keep on bringing this up, because not enough people have watched my Edward Bernays lecture. Right, you go back in the past couple of weeks of the channel, you will find Edward Bernays. That is the video on engineering consent, manufacturing consent, and the techniques used by the likes of Bernays. Also videos by Walter Lippmann. I've talked a lot about propaganda and the manufacturing of consent. There was a whole week I dedicated to it. I looked at Althusser as well, and at Gustave Le Bon that week. So, yeah, there's plenty of material there. But Alul himself says that this is like part of, this is not some separate, you know, it's not like you've got the technological society over here and you've got propaganda over there. It is where there is a technological society, you will get the propaganda is an indivisible part of how the system functions. If there was not manufacturing consent, if there were not things like nudge units and DSM-5 and all the other things that, you know, nudge people into behaving in the right sorts of ways, the whole system couldn't work. We get the impossibility of selective use. So there is the colonization thesis, where once the technical system is established, it tends to spread into all remaining domains. There is no stable middle ground, as partial adoption creates pressure for full adoption. And selectivity, right? That is, okay, we're going to adopt these things, but we're not going to adopt these things. This fails because opting out of specific technologies whilst remaining embedded in a technical society is largely illusionary. The infrastructure, incentives, and norms of technique are already pervasive. Alul rejects reformist optimism. One cannot adopt technique only where convenient. The system demands total integration. So, you know, in the modern debates about digital ID, for example, you know, in a way, Alul is saying, well, it's only a matter of time. Well, you think you, like, this is what technique is. You think you can opt out? You can't. There is no opt out. This is the system, and the system is total. And if you have a look at the various debates and the various resistances to this technology or that technology or this way of doing things or that way of doing things, I would love somebody to argue against this, to show, hey, listen, Jack Alul, here are 20 different examples since 1945, mind you, right, in the modern age, right? If your examples of, you know, China in 1250 or something, doesn't matter because they weren't in this age. I'm talking about since 1945, modern age, 10 times where, you know, for a company or a government successfully resisted the adoption of some newfangled thing that came in that was all pervasive elsewhere, but they just resisted themselves. Can't think of many at all. The top of my head, you know, like Nintendo refused to take the CD, right? But you could argue that that kind of gave Sony an in there. And actually during that era, Nintendo lost a step. I don't know. Like you'd have to have a real think about it. But I'm really interested in this, in the scope for picking and choosing. Alul doesn't see any at all. You know, you think, well, you know, Blockbuster Video, everybody thinks of that. You know, they put up a fight for a while, but in the end, it was inevitable that it would be wiped out. HMV and Virgin and all of those stores, you know, they were like, oh, yeah, we're going to stick with the old ways. It didn't last for long. So I think that, you know, even if you could think of some examples, right, of limited resistance in this area or that area, in the long run, it feels like Alul basically is right that there's just no way. You just have to kind of fully adopt. And this is kind of its own catch-22 because, you know, I've mentioned Tony Blair a number of times in this video. If you internalize this and you kind of support the technical or the technological society, then you then and you see this, you see what Alul is saying, oh, basically, you know, it's going to go this way, then you become a little bit like a Tony Blair. You become a kind of tech evangelist who is like, look, this is happening, so we have to get on board. We have to get on board. What about this, Tony? What about it? Doesn't matter. It's happening. We have to get on board. If we don't get on board, we're going to be left behind. And that, and so the whole thing has its own momentum that you can just never escape from, which is what Alul is talking about. And of course, in such a society, a man like Tony Blair or is going to gravitate to the top, or to put it more accurately, a man like Tony Blair will transform himself to become what he needs to be on top. And what does he need to be? A man of technique, a manager, a tech evangelist, a champion of technique, a man who has spent the last 30 to 40 years saying this is inevitable because this is the future. If it's inevitable, why do you spend all your time trying to make it happen? I've often wondered. Anyway, let's carry on. We get, under these conditions, according to Alul, the crisis of meaning. As technique becomes total, questions of ultimate purpose are displaced. The system furnishes means without ends, an ever-expanding apparatus of efficiency orientated towards nothing beyond itself. Technique is the translation into action of man's concern to master things by means of reason. Human life, increasingly organized around technical performance, finds itself rich in capacity, yet impoverished in direction. And this really has been the underlying story of our age. Last week I talked about the postmodern condition, the search for authenticity, the search for purpose, the search for meaning. In many ways, this is the question that has been asked since Nietzsche. What do you do in a society where God is dead? This is ultimately the question that many of the thinkers I've looked at, Julius Evola, for example, was trying to answer. And René Guénon, who I just mentioned, like maybe there'll be a video on Guénon down the line. And it's difficult to come to any other conclusion that pretty much the chances of rescuing this society, society-wide, in mass and scale, kind of a write-off. These forces are too strong. They are inevitable, as Blair says, and as Alul says. The political game is sewn up. So then you think, well, okay, you can't save everybody, so maybe just save yourself. Maybe save your own soul. We won't be able to do it en masse. Maybe you can select few can do it. This is the meaning of the aristocrat of the soul that Evola talks about. And in a way, even thinking in terms of the mass, in terms of everybody, not just in terms of a few people, is part and parcel of the age of technique. It is the manager who thinks in terms of everybody. So, of kind of trying to engineer a solution that will work for all people. Maybe if you're thinking like that, you're already thinking in terms of technique rather than in terms of individual quality. Something to ponder. And this is it for Alul. Now, Alul is a very complex thinker, and he has got lots of great material. I have barely scratched the surface with this lecture today. And I know I say that every time, right? I say these are introductory lectures. We're just kind of getting to know people. I'm giving you a few, rudimentary, really, bits of theory and lingo in which to think in a different way about the world. But I do encourage you to read on. And in the case of Alul, there is a lot more to say. My buddies Scrump and Evelyn have done work on Alul in the past. Check out their blog, Anti-Politics, or their book, Anti-Politics, where they talk about Alul. And they've given lectures on him that I've seen in the past as well. So there's a lot more out there on Alul, but we're just kind of starting here. This is more true of Alul than many of the other people we've talked about, because there's a lot of these books. There are two books about that big that I condensed into a 30-minute lecture. So there's so much more to talk about. For me, with a lot of these thinkers, it's more than just kind of learning their ideas. It is thinking about things in a certain way. Okay, and that's what I'm trying to, that's why I was talking about DSM, for example. That is simply one way in of thinking about how has our society got to this point where a book like this exists and why does it exist? And someone like Alul can give us a way of thinking about that problem, because I do think it exists because of the addiction to technique that he talks about. All right. Pick up a course at the academic agency. That'll do for today. I'll catch you tomorrow, where we're going to continue talking about mass and scale with Samuel T. Francis. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available.
Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.